This is Cody McLean from the Mind Hack Podcast, a place where we explore the routines, mindset, and experiences of successful people in their field, whatever that field may be. Today, we're primarily looking at self-guided learning, flow, and the power of nature. These tools are helpful for everyone, but especially for entrepreneurs and creatives who can benefit from unplugging and de-stressing in order to live a happier and more productive life. My guest today is Kyle Pierce, the founder of DIYGenius.com and an experiential learning designer, digital business educator, and also runs educational nature retreats. Kyle spent the last 7 years building DIY Genius by sharing his passion for self-education and teaching online courses in passion-driven learning, flow psychology, and digital storytelling. He's a full-stack marketer, and when he's not working, you'll find him in the forest, in mountain biking, skiing, or hiking. In this interview, we detail Kyle's story along with his successes and failures along the way. You'll get a better understanding of the benefits of travel, as well as how to induce a better flow state to increase the quality of your work. Kyle is an entrepreneur who leads retreats in nature and spends half the year traveling the world, and now dedicates his life to helping others discover their true passion so they can use it positively to impact the world. So please welcome Kyle Pierce.
Thanks for having me on, Cody.
Now, when I saw your website, Do It Yourself Genius, you have a lot about flow psychology and overall educational tools about kind of understanding yourself at a deeper level and also learning yourself, stuff that they don't typically teach you in schools. I'm curious, can you tell me how you got started down this path of education and also even what your childhood was like when you were going to school?
Sure. All right, I'll start with my childhood. So I was like that rambunctious, super curious kid. I lived in the country. I had dogs. I loved just hiking and exploring, spending the day outside. And when I got into school, to me, it felt like a prison. Just the way of learning seemed so distant from what I wanted to do myself, the way I learned naturally outside. And I just found just the education model so dry, I guess, but looking back at least, and just sitting all day being this kind of high energy kid was really hard for me. And you know, I was like that disruptive kind of class clown and really struggled in school early on. Later on, did pretty well. But yeah, I just always felt like there was something wrong with the school system. And at least for someone like me, who was highly creative and energetic, it just didn't feel like it was a good place for me to learn.
So did you classify yourself as having ADHD when you were young?
Yeah, I would be characterized as that, although I've never really done the medication or any of that stuff.
And so how did that lead you to, so you graduated college, you were able to get through all that despite the difficulties?
Yeah. So when I was in university, I went to the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. And it's this university, it's in the middle of a 2,000 acre forest surrounded by beaches, old growth trees, and really kind of a wild place. And I just found the university so just reductionist and mechanistic and the lectures so dry. And I was in this forest and I wanted to learn outside more. And I just wondered why no one ever went in the forest really for learning and being, you know, spending time outside really learning through direct experience rather than just through books and lectures. And that kind of led me to looking at a different model of education for myself. So I finished UBC and then I went and I traveled the world and, you know, learned all over the world from ecology teachers and meditation teachers. And that kind of sparked me on this learning journey.
Was there anything specifically like an experience that started this transformation where you started to tell yourself school's not right for me and I need to find other methods of learning?
Yeah, I would say when I was at UBC, there was a beach there called Wreck Beach. I'd go down there to these huge parties with these travelers I would pass through from all over the world. And, you know, one guy in particular from California, I remember he just told me his stories of how he lived and how he traveled the world and was like a gypsy and, you know, sold, you know, food and whatnot as he traveled. And he lived in the forest near Wreck Beach for a while. And I was just like, as this young student, you know, in this very structured, rigid environment, I just was really struck by that people could live in this totally different way and have this level of freedom that was kind of rare in this world. So I'd say that meeting people like that at a young age, like when I was in university, really led me down this path in a big way.
So you, in some ways, you were enlightened to another way of living other than the alternative method that I think most of us see when we grow up. We go to school, we see other people, they have a job, they go to work 9 to 5, they come home, they get married, they have a baby, and that is your life. And so seeing this traveling gypsy changed that perspective for you, right? And so then you also mentioned you started traveling and you met a meditation teacher. Can you tell me a little bit about where you went and what experiences you had that also changed your perspective even further?
Yeah. So in 2011, I got into a startup incubator in Chile called Startup Chile. And down there, I worked at a co-working space with entrepreneurs from 35 countries. And I just heard people's stories about, you know, how businesses were built in different countries and their startup scenes in different countries and made connections. And after that, I had all these people to visit all over the world. And I had like people to stay with and people that really kind of introduced me to local investors and entrepreneurs and the kind of creative people. So after Startup Chile, I moved to Thailand. I lived on an island called Koh Phangan. And there I just learned a lot about the Vedic library of knowledge and Eastern teachings. Met a lot of teachers there. And then kind of just from there, I just became like a digital nomad. And I went to different places in the world where I knew people and, you know, made connections. And and then I realized like I love living in Canada where I'm from and all that. But I don't like the winters that much, as you can imagine. So I would spend usually half the year traveling, working abroad, and that kind of like really had a big influence on me.
And so tell me a little bit about what you do today with Do-It-Yourself Genius.
Yeah. So I basically help people develop their focus, become more creative, and become highly self-motivated. So how to work outside of the typical system of being an employee, having a boss managing you, how to manage yourself, and then how to set long-term learning goals to really learn the things and master the things that are going to make you a huge asset in this world and allow you to make a big impact. So I kind of combine that with like storytelling and marketing automation if someone wants to teach or whatnot, and just how to like focus your time where you get the most value and find, you know, technology to automate the rest or to delegate to people that are specialized in different things that you're not good at. So I kind of combine those things together to help creatives become more focused and productive.
So then it's about telling somebody if they're working at a job, how they can kind of stop working at that job and go find their own hobby, their own passion. Can you tell me what you would tell somebody like that if you met them? If I'm that person and I'm stuck in this job, I don't really know what I should do next.
Yeah. So what I would say is start learning on the side. You know, what you want to learn, like map out what you really love to do, what you're really good at, like your natural talents and your experiences you have, maybe your education you have, and then look at a problem in the world or a challenge that you really care about, you could solve with what you're passionate about and what you're good at. And then, you know, start getting clear about your messaging, you know, and how you can start to tell a story of your skills and your passion and how you solve a problem. And then around that problem, you know, start doing things like starting your side hustle or a website or joining a movement and learning that way, learning through mentorship and through maybe apprenticeship under people and learning by doing really around a problem you really care deeply about. And starting off, while you have a 9-to-5 income or whatever you do, you know, have that stability to learn for a while and spend time until you're ready to take the leap, quit your job and do something and make a full-time income. Because it's not as easy as people think. It doesn't happen as fast. Like the way I always tell people, like people spend 4 or 5 years in university and they graduate often with very little skills of value in the market. So to build a business, you know, think 4 or 5 years to really build like a really, really valuable business that, you know, can work without you working on it all the time and, you know, have equity built where you could sell, that kind of thing. I think people think things are going to happen too fast. And it's important to have stability. It's important to have an income that supports, you know, your lifestyle.
For me, it was an issue of self-confidence and belief. My parents died when I was young. I dropped out of high school. I had all these barriers. And for the longest time, I thought I was stupid. And that self-loathing stopped me from trying to achieve.
Yeah. And you probably achieved what you did because of your obstacles that you had in life, right?
Yeah. And also I use the term, my bridges were burnt for me. I wasn't able to go back. And I've seen even a lot of high school, I mean, college grads, that they graduate and they have this low expectation for themselves, like that they'll just be happier. Like even guys who graduate from computer science at UT, I've seen where they tell themselves they'll just be happy to get an internship after they graduate, but they're mm-hmm. fully capable of getting jobs at Apple and Google and 100K plus. They're wanted that much, but yet they don't have the experience and the belief in themselves to even try something like being an entrepreneur or an expectation of what the salary they can get.
Yeah, I think part of it is the school system in a way. People that don't really learn through that normal model can end up feeling they're stupid. And a lot of entrepreneurs I've met, the most successful people I've met and many people I've worked with, you know, didn't feel they're all that great in school or in that model. But in the real world, with building relationships and, you know, taking risks and being creative and finding ways to serve people and give value to them, they thrive. So it's interesting that, like, yeah, it's just about shifting your story about yourself that you tell to yourself. And really the best way to do that is surround yourself with entrepreneurs and creatives and people that believe in you, because it's common in families and social circles, the classroom, you know, to be with around people that don't really support you and really see your true gift. So you got to kind of seek that out and find the people that bring it out of you.
Yeah, the amount of times I've heard from somebody who said that they want to do a business, but their mom or their dad or their parents, somebody told them like, you can't do that, or you don't have the money. And then they never even try because of that. It's interesting how sometimes our friends and our family can be the most negative influence towards trying to accomplish our ambitions, but I think they're doing it in a method of trying to protect us. But I think that even goes back to how we should raise our children. And I know that there were studies about helicopter parenting a while ago. And the overall perspective that I got from the, I know, side topic, but that you should let your kids be willing to make mistakes as long as they don't hurt themselves. And yeah. That's the truest method for them to learn. Because if you tell them not to eat cookies out of the cookie jar, you know, when you're not around, they're going to put all those cookies in their mouth, or they're going to go after they leave home for college, they're going to be buying all the cookies from the store. So it's an interesting thought. What are your thoughts on that?
It's interesting, like with kids, like we're used to schooling, or because we're all highly schooled, you know, in a Western country, this rewards and punishment system, you know, do this and you're good, and do that, don't do that, or you're bad. And really, like, you know, taking risks is important for kids. Like, young boys should climb trees, should, you know, get dirty, should scrape themselves, should, you know, like do things where they might even sometimes break a bone or whatever, right? Like, because then you learn. And if you don't do those things, you live this fragile, air-conditioned life. I think people don't develop their true capabilities. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, really encouraging kids is important, and adults too. Because like, if you're not encouraged as a kid, you need that mentor as you grow up to like really help you shift your perception of yourself.
Yeah. And I think that you have the Jim Rohn's quote, you are the average of the five people you are around the most. And I think it's a very true quote. I've noticed just the pressure of being in a gym. I feel like it's an easy example is that if you try and work out at home versus if you work out in a gym, the social pressure of the people around you force you to perform better. At least that's for me, because I want to make sure that they're not judging me by having the incorrect form, or that they feel like I'm taking a 2-minute break between each rep, that I perform better just by having people around me and even having friends that encourage you. I think that's a great step that you can focus at, because I think a lot of entrepreneurs start without the support around them first.
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing, because you're going to fail a lot. It's like 90% of businesses fail. You know, mm-hmm. Even 90% of venture capital-backed startups fail. So you're going to fail. You're probably going to fail 2 or 3, 4, 5 times before you succeed. And hopefully your failures aren't too costly that, you know, you have to give up. But like having that support along the way is so important. And not just from people that work 9 to 5, but they're going to have their own perspective on things and probably want to talk to you out of what you're doing. And maybe for good reason, right? But you got to have the entrepreneurial kind of support of people that have been through this and can help you not make the mistakes that most people make that end up in failure. So mm-hmm. I think, yeah, the mentorship, the support is really, really important.
So how would you divide support between people, books, courses? Where have you gained the knowledge that has helped you continue down this path to creating a successful online courses?
Yeah, so definitely documentaries have been huge for me.
Any particular?
Books, audiobooks, podcasts, Googling things I discover on social media, things people tell me about, you know, for learning. all that stuff's been very important for sparking my interest in things, going deep into things. But I'd say the most valuable things that I've done have been retreats with people and gatherings, like where it's like you're staying together for a period of days or weeks at a time, being in co-living and co-working communities that are entrepreneurs, mastermind groups I've been part of, where all have the similar goals and we're being held accountable. Those kind of forms of learning, like mentorship, apprenticeship, collaboration, I found that learning with the right people has really been a huge thing that's helped me grow much more than just the books and the kind of easy forms of learning that don't require you to challenge yourself as much.
Yeah, definitely. I love reading books and I love taking online courses, but it's always been the experiential, the experiences, the conferences that I feel like I walk away with the most inspiration and motivation and just drive and newfound passion to try and accomplish what I'm trying to accomplish, especially when you see other people doing it.
Yeah. And it's like the mindset thing of like, you're around people with a certain mindset, just as being a social animal, you're going to adopt it. So you got to be around people with mindsets that really force you to question some of your assumptions and some of your limitations and whatnot.
And just backtracking on what you said previously, off the top of your head, are there any documentaries, books, conferences, or even specific retreats that you can name?
Oh yeah, tons. Documentaries, Google Mind Expand documentaries. I have a list of 300 that I love. You know, recently I just saw a film last week called The Coming War on China that was quite dark. A meditation documentary called Inner Worlds, Outer Worlds I really like. For ecology, I like a film called Call of the Forest. And then for retreats, I do retreats for ecological change makers. So I kind of get to pick the people that come often. And those have been hugely influencing me. Running them has been a huge influence. And the people I've met doing those have been big. I have a Flow Productivity Mastermind where I get to work directly with all these entrepreneurs around keeping each other accountable. And that daily accountability has really helped me. So lots of different things over the years, like many different music festivals, many different, you know, conscious gatherings around the world and entrepreneurial, like co-working retreats, that kind of stuff.
Can you talk about more about your retreat that you have? Is that on an annual basis?
Yeah. So I have an organization called Animist Ecology. I started about 4 years ago teaching meditation and ancient history and ecology in the forest in Stanley Park and in Vancouver. It's a beautiful wild park beside downtown Vancouver. And from that, I just developed into doing retreats around the world. I do usually at least five every year. And I do them in Thailand. We do sailing retreats, going to like tropical islands, completely unplugged, and doing one in the Rocky Mountains in August, one in the Western rainforests of Vancouver Island in August as well. And yeah, it's just bringing together people in nature to learn about plants and trees and fungi and how we're part of nature and the language of nature that we don't really learn in the Western culture much. The ancestral knowledge that's kind of been lost in modern times around, you know, our connection to the land and our connection to each other and our connection to, you know, a larger historical human tradition. So I teach like animism, which really is like the ancient way of seeing the world, of direct communication with nature, direct living in nature, and reverence and respect for it.
Mm.
So I do that and really learning through the senses rather than learning conceptually through books and lectures and textbooks.
Now I have to ask, do any of your retreats involve plant medicine?
No, no. Mm. I teach people about like healing plants that grow all around them, healing fungi, mushrooms, but I'm not really a shaman. It's not my lineage, my tradition. If people are interested in that, I think it's a great thing if it's done respectfully and mindfully and with the right people. My focus is more on the meditation on how do you create long-term changes that don't require some sort of chemical that alters your consciousness, which, you know, it can be a valuable tool for people, but I think long-term, really having that connection to our land and really developing autonomy in our own mind is something that really needs to be approached through meditation and discipline and habit formation and stuff.
Mm. I wanted to mention a Tim Ferriss here in Austin a few months ago during South By. He sent out an email that about a premiere for a movie called Fantastic Fungi by a documentary by Louis Schwartzberg. Have you?
I've seen it.
Yeah, that was a fantastic documentary, just not realizing that every footstep in the forest, that all the trees and the roots, everything is connected with fungi underground. And it has such a huge impact that none of us really are aware of.
Yeah, and that film's amazing because Louis Schwarzberg is a phenomenal cinematographer, and the way he does the long-term time lapses, you really see mushrooms in a way you would never be able to see in the wild, growing over their whole cycle. And then Paul Stamets, to me, I've learned a lot from him. I hold him in very high regard. And just the way he speaks about it so eloquently and animistically, he's not like your typical dry academic in any way.
Mm. Now, piggybacking on what you said about earlier about being more connected with nature, you know, in the past, I think earlier this year or late last year, the CDC said that we have a higher rate of anxiety and depression among teens and young adults. And I think it's pretty obvious that's connected to smartphone use. So now that you're on this end about teaching people to be more connected with their consciousness, I'm curious, what have you seen? What is your expert opinion on where society is and what are the problems that are causing this increase in anxiety, depression, bullying in school and whatnot?
Yeah, I think a big part of it is our attention is so fragmented today. The way people work and learn goes against the way our brain is structured. Mm-hmm. And multitasking is a good example. Most people are addicted to doing it, addicted to the dopamine, cortisol, adrenaline release that happens through chronically doing it. And I see kids in a Starbucks studying and they're checking their phone, their iPad, and their computer, and every minute or two they switch back and forth. And you really can't really learn effectively that way and really develop your potential. So the biggest thing I think people need to do is really develop habits around immersion in their activities. So I think that's huge. And then anxiety also, I think, is made worse by that. But a lot of anxiety in the world is maybe valid because we're living in a time of great change and instability, and a lot of people aren't prepared for it. And we need a system that prepares people better for a very uncertain future where automation, artificial intelligence will do so much of what humans used to do. So we really got to look now more on like what makes people uniquely human, you know, versus a robot, right? And learn those capacities like empathy and storytelling and leadership and creativity. So that's huge. And I also think for me, spending time in nature, it diminishes your self-importance and your self-criticism. Because when you're in a natural wild environment, you realize how small you are as a person in this beautiful way. And it reduces rumination. Like, I think a lot of people are depressed and anxious, suffer from bad ADD, that kind of stuff. A weekend or a week immersed in nature could change their whole life. Yeah. Reconnecting with something way beyond what they thought was possible and really get away from their sort of survival strategies in these unhealthy communities and cities and stuff, and where it's very competitive, and get away and really think about who they really are and why they're here and just their connection to nature. I think that as a culture, we need to redevelop rituals like that.
Yeah, that is, I think, a great summary of some of the problems and what we need to do, because I think we're so attached to our ego, our feelings are, that when you go into nature and the wild and you look around you, in some ways that it's this idea of ego dissolution where our feelings are so attached to our ego, right? And who we are and our purpose, and we make up a story about ourselves, that when we see the plants or the trees around us, we realize just somewhat how insignificant we are. And there was a while where I was a bit of a nihilist, but then there's a great video on YouTube about the optimistic nihilist. And at the end of the video, he talks about how in some ways, I think everything is meaningless, but that gives you the opportunity to create your own meaning. And that was a little bit of an eye-opening moment for me, that I can define what is meaningful for me. And then going through and figuring out, reading Simon Sinek's book, Why, and then going through his whole process on like discovering what is my own meaning. Because I think there's this other problem where we all operate without this deeper sense of meaning. And I've seen 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds that feel like they don't know what they want to do with their life still. Not that they still don't have the time to do it. And sometimes I feel like they just give up or they never think about it.
Yeah, meaning is a big thing. Like, I think people rely too much on other people's experiences, you know, whether it's in school or in church or whatever. What's important is your experience, your immediate felt experience, and learning through stories that you can tell. And I think that's really valuable for creating meaning. You know, like meaning is a very powerful thing, having a purpose, a higher purpose that guides your life in some way, whether it's religious or philosophical or whatever someone chooses. I think having that autonomy, mastery, and purpose in your life really like lights a fire in a way that traditional work and education doesn't do.
Is there any place that people can go to start? Any book that comes to mind? Should they just go off and travel and then find something?
Well, I'd say traveling is the best form of education, especially if someone's always done 9-to-5 or done the traditional school system. you know, go spend, do a meditation retreat somewhere in India or, you know, in the Himalayas, or even if a Vipassana retreat in your area, you know, free retreats people can do and by donation. And experience was like to be a monk for a week, you know, what it's like to not be attached to this identity for a week. And lots of different ways to do it. But books, yeah, definitely lots of books. On my website, I have links to lots of kind of futuristic books and ancient books. I just did a post on audiobooks. I'm a huge fan of audiobooks. So like just putting aside some time every week and just listening to audiobooks, you can get them for free online, many of them, or you get like an Audible subscription. There's different ways to do it. But basically listening to lots of books when you're traveling and commuting and bored and trying to unplug from screens more. And yeah. For me, I read a lot on screens and I do read a lot of books, but I just get tired of just looking at things all the time. And I find that when I go for a long walk in nature or by the seashore, I can just listen to an audiobook while I'm experiencing the world around me and kind of have this kind of flow going. I found that really helpful for learning.
Do you ever choose not to listen to a podcast when you're out running or by the sea?
Yeah, often I don't. And even I might just do sessions, maybe a half hour listening to one while I'm sitting on a bench or walking around. But I kind of like the way I teach and the way I kind of spend time in nature, I kind of oscillate back and forth between like learning about the world around me and plants and mushrooms and looking for things. And then to oscillating back and forth to just complete immersion, you know, more kind of less analysis, less more felt presence. Mm. So I might listen to an audio book for a while, then I'll put it on pause and then I'll just kind of listen to the birds for a while or watch the trees moving in the wind, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and you use the word immersion. And I think that's something that it's more difficult for us to find nowadays since we're always, you know, you're in a store. And I've sat in a waiting room and everybody else is looking at their phones. And then I was going to take my phone out. I'm like, hell no, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to be better than them because I'm not going to look at my phone. And that's an ego thing aside. But apart from that, we are constantly finding time to distract ourselves. Like we're now watching Netflix while looking at our phones. And it's like, we're constantly having this lack of external stimuli that we're trying to distract ourselves with stuff. And it leaves no room for our subconscious to think, to bring out those creative ideas. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, psychologists have called that continuous partial attention. It's probably the state that the majority of people in a developed Western country live in today.
I think it's called the default mode network as well.
Yeah, I think it's good for advertisers that target people that are distractible. But I think it's bad for the person that has that deals with that. And we all deal with it to some extent, right? It's just being mindful of it and starting to be aware of it and to build habits to counteract these forces that want to harvest our attention, right? Yeah. It's like, you know, if the product's free, you're the product being sold to the advertiser. And it's big business, like Facebook and Google and friends, they're big businesses. Like they're monopolistic, they're global. Like, yeah, and they just want to know everything about you because then they could target you better. So I think it's really important that people develop like a meditation practice, nature rituals to completely unplug from these screens that dominate our lives. Because it's very destructive to our long-term well-being. And one of the things I always say to people is that like today, no one thinks smoking is healthy, right? And most people are smoking or trying to quit or quit a long time ago or are dead maybe. So people don't smoke much. But look at like our smartphones, like they're in our pockets, all these signals, up to 800 signals a day coming in and out, or sorry, an hour, or I think it's a minute even. Can't remember exactly the number, but it's huge. The amount of signals coming in and out of a phone constantly per minute is insane. And it's right in your crotch, you know, so that's not good maybe for your long-term health down there. And then also for your body, you're in these fields all around you. And now with 5G, we have these more intense fields. And it's not the way humans have really been evolved to live. So unplugging from this is, I think, really important. And I think our smartphones, the way they divide our attention, and social media, the way it makes people more narcissistic, will one day be seen the way we look at smoking now as this very negative thing, a bad habit, if not managed well, that can really ruin people's quality of their lives.
Mm. And on top of that, I've been reading this great book by Cal Newport called Digital Minimalism. And that's where he's bringing up this concept that we need to stop distracting ourselves. And it made me realize that I would often, like, if I would go to the bathroom, I like pull out my phone. And now I'm trying to challenge myself not to do that. There is even an app, like I looked on my screen time and it said I use my phone like 4 hours a day. And I'm like, wow, I use it that much. Yeah. And, but then I also ask myself, what are the things I use to distract myself? And there's a Google app, which they have this thing called Trending News. So it combines my Google searches and it will find interesting articles that will always show at the bottom. So I'll open up the app with the intent of searching for something. And then I get distracted by all these relevant articles of things I'm interested in. And after going through Cal Newport, I realized like, wow, this is a big distraction. And so I actually disabled that. I'm just going to go back to Chrome app if I need it. But little tiny tweaks like that can help you try and be more mindful and not be constantly trying to achieve this state of distraction by our phones.
Yeah. I think minimalism is key. Like a big thing in my life last few years has really helped me is really analyzing what that actually gets me results and what is actually a time waster and what is just busy work. And most work ends up being busy work if you don't really structure and prioritize very carefully.
How do you structure and prioritize your day?
So I have a program called Flow Productivity where I go through a lot of my processes and I've been teaching it for almost 5 years now. And basically I really develop a clear creative vision for my life. And I'm always iterating and improving and fine tuning it of like the legacy I want to leave, the impact I want to make in the world. And then from that, I drill down to like yearly, monthly, weekly, daily goals, daily tasks connected to those goals. And then I plan out my week every Sunday. I have a mastermind meeting on Sunday. We planned everything out. And then I'm held accountable to that by the people in the group. And then I know what I'm doing each day, like my main things I need to work on in terms of results I need to generate. And then I use that structure to actually work less than probably most people. You know, I often take the afternoon off and go for a hike or go to the lake or whatever, right? Just hang out with people and or just read or whatever. Just because I'm very productive the first half of the day, I get probably double the what I used to get done, you know, when I didn't have that structure. So just having a very clear plan that's realistic and accountability and feedback loops to kind of fine tune it, I think for me is really important for good productivity long term.
Yeah, I used to be, my business was my breakfast, lunch, and dinner, is that all I would do was the company and work on it consistently. And when you don't close the structure in terms of when you're working, then you're always working. And it's very, very difficult to switch into the I'm hanging out with friends mode because I would constantly be thinking I could be working right now and it would drain me, right? And so setting a structure, setting your intentions, and there's a lot of different variations of that, right? And I think one of the things I was starting to do was setting your three goals for the day. And if you just accomplish your first goal, that would be okay. Like the idea of being able to walk away if you only accomplish one or those three goals and being content with that. And I did that. And it's surprisingly, it's a good feeling to have instead of constantly lingering like, oh, I could be working or I should go do more work, etc.
Yeah, that's a key thing for flow is like having that highest priority, that number one goal for the day and tackling that first when your energy is best. You know? And then once you've tackled that and you've done that, you have a sense of enjoyment and gratitude, you know, you have this momentum that carries the rest of your day.
Now, there's another great book about it's called Daily Rituals. I don't know if you've read it, about different creative artists and what their routines were. And I like this one by Ernest Hemingway. He would write a story, but then once he's like in the flow is that he would pause so that the next day he could return to that moment instead of say you complete one chapter, then you finish what you have to say. And then the next day it's so much more difficult because you have to start from a blank state. And I like that concept as well.
He also drank a lot too, like a lot of them.
And actually, that's interesting that there were actually a lot of the artists in there. They took stimulants, they did do drugs, they drank a lot, and a lot of them didn't lead very happy lives. And in fact, I remember some of the writers is that they felt like they had to be depressed in order to write.
Yeah, it's like similar with musicians. Like, if you just write peppy love songs all day, you're not going to have any fans. Mm. Yeah.
But obviously, that's not the most healthiest method. And I think we want to optimize not only for our impact in the world, but there was also a realization I came to a few years ago where prior I would tell people, I'm not trying to achieve happiness, I'm trying to achieve greatness. And I didn't say that from an egoistic perspective. I meant that I wanted to accomplish something and I was willing to sacrifice my own happiness in order to do that. But then I later realized that you have to be happy in order to meaningfully make work towards that goal. You have to put yourself first. You have to put your health first and all those things. Yeah. And I changed my perspective a little bit.
That's great. Yeah, happiness is so oversold today. Like the whole pursuit of happiness is really just the pursuit of money and status. And usually the pursuit of that wears people out. And even the people that have really lots of money and lots of status, most of them are slaves in a different way. Like, they're working all the time. They're still paycheck to paycheck often, you know, and as you mentioned, like as an entrepreneur, if you can't delegate and work with people you trust, you're working all the time. Like you're working yourself into the ground. Like a lot of very successful people in business don't live that long. Like being hopped up on stimulants and, you know, being control freaks and all that stuff doesn't do well for your long-term health.
Yeah. And certainly putting yourself first. I also came to a realization since I was waking up, I would eat a bowl of cereal and then I would work for the rest of the day. But now I have my routine. I call my mind, my body, my soul, where I will meditate for 20 minutes. I'll exercise for about 45, 60, and then I'll also read a book for 30 minutes. And I do that all prior to starting work because I know if I delayed it, it'd be much more difficult to do on a consistent basis.
Well, it's great what you do, how you have this global business and outsourcing and providing support for people. Like, yeah, that's the new way of business. Like you have to specialize in what you're not like, be it a widely knowledgeable things, but specialize your time in what you like to do and you're good at and outsource or delegate the rest. It's the only way to really be an entrepreneur in the digital age without going out of your mind, you know?
Yeah. And you're constantly having to learn new skills as well.
Yeah. Well, big time.
And so can you explain a little bit more about what flow is? Because I know that's been a big part of your world and also what you teach other entrepreneurs.
Yeah. So flow was developed by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, a professor at the University of Chicago in the 70s and 80s. And he looked at all these top performers, you know, gold medal athletes and executives that were, you know, highly successful entrepreneurs. And he found that they often talked about that they would get in these flowy-like states where they were totally immersed in what they were doing and they were very focused on things they were good at and were meaningful and challenging. And they would lose themselves in their work and, you know, be up all night sometimes and skip meals and just float out of them in a sense. And he developed flow psychology out of that, out of a lot of the research. And he defined flow as a psychology of optimal experience. And a flow state is being a state where you feel and perform your best. And then you'd have different depths of it. So it's a spectrum from just deep focus of working on one thing at a time and not looking at anything else for, you know, hours at a time as you train yourself. And then creative flow when you're jamming, you know, in front of people, like public speaking, that kind of stuff. And then, you know, he also got into some of the peak states, transcendental like experiences, religious experiences, where people would have the, you know, selflessness, timelessness, deep immersion and richness in their experiences. And it's basically flow is about understanding what should you focus on and what is tied to what you're intrinsically motivated by, you know, and getting really, you know, doing a deep dive into what you're passionate about, how you can use it to serve others, how you can get a level of mastery at it. And then how you can really build this purpose-driven creative life designed around seeking flow in many ways.
Would you consider the flow as well, things like sports when you're playing, when you're running?
There's all different kinds. It's like, and one person will get into flow maybe running. You know, they get the runner's high or they run for an hour or a whole marathon. And there's times during that where their mind is so clear and they get these very deep insights and they get this like reset where they're doing some pretty intense exercise. And it helps them recharge for other things in their life. And other people might be like, oh, running is stupid. You know, I hate running. So it's like different people do different things. Some people might do it through music. But I think it should be directed to what the way we work and the way we learn too. Because when you're in flow working on things that are challenging and meaningful to you, it's the ultimate thing for being an entrepreneur and for learning by doing. And creating these challenges, these high consequence challenges that force you to learn what you need to know to do something you want to do. And that's kind of like the lifelong learning thing today, where you just got to want to do something and then you got to figure out to do it along the way. And And to me, that's a much more interesting way to learn than just in school, where it's just for a test, for imaginary group work and all the stuff that's done, which is very low consequences, unless you really highly value the grades, maybe. But it's not a very flowy environment for people that are more creative and oriented toward purpose.
Right. And you also have to work on something that has meaning and impact to you. And even sometimes I'll write, but sometimes I feel like I'm just scraping my fingernails against the chalkboard in terms of the difficulty and the resistance. But there's often times that I will find a certain flow with the writing and then I can't stop and I'll write all night. And I don't take any caffeine and I'll just be up till 5 a.m. in the morning because I feel so connected to what is coming out. I refer to them as like a brain dump, right? And I feel so connected to it. And I think to have a flow with exercise is fantastic. And some people, that is their life. I mean, professional football, basketball players, et cetera. But then to have a flow when you're writing music or to write or when you're coding, I think that's the most brilliant part of all, because you have something tangible that you can say, I did this. And that gives you this greater sense of satisfaction.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And there's this flow cycle where you struggle, you get a release, you get into a flow state or have deep creative insights and you have a recovery. So it's like this beautiful state where you describe, you can be up all night, get the most productive work done. But a lot of people struggle to get consistently into that state because they burn themselves out. They don't recover enough. And then really the productivity thing is really learning to struggle better in a way you don't get hijacked by your inner critic or procrastination and focus, lack of focus, right? So flow really gets into like how we create and how we execute our ideas and the challenges and obstacles that come up. Because as you know, as an entrepreneur, like the stuff that makes you money is not the easy stuff to do, right?
I feel like that's also a reason why a lot of people get into entrepreneurship, because there is that one book called The Checklist Manifesto that, or it was the E-Myth, where they had the example of a woman who wanted to make cupcakes and she opened up a shop, but then she realized all she loved doing was baking cupcakes. She didn't like managing business, hiring employees and all that stuff you have to do. And so she closed the business. She lost the money on the loan and she just went back to being an employee. And that's what she found intrinsic purpose. So being an entrepreneur, it's amazing to have the opportunity to work entirely on your flow, but then you can't neglect the things that you have to do in order to make the business grow and scale and all that fun stuff.
There's all different ways to get into flow. It's just, you know, having your passions and your hobbies, and you know, there's all different ways. It doesn't necessarily have to be an entrepreneurship thing, but I find entrepreneurship is like a flow-seeking life. Like it's the highest rewards for flow. But it's riskier too, right? And I think also in the kind of North American culture, we don't talk enough about how people fail, you know, and the bankruptcy and losing everything. And I've been through some big failures in my life. And most of the entrepreneurs I know that are actually successful have been through big failures. And it's learning to deal with that failure is something that's not easy. It kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, about that support network so important. Mm.
Can you tell me about a failure that you had and how you recovered from it?
Yeah. So my first retreat I ever did was in Thailand, and it was a few years back. And, you know, I ran marketing for it, and I hadn't really done a lot of global retreat marketing, getting people to fly from Europe and North America and Australia to Thailand. And I did my first retreat ever with one person, you know, one person. Right. And that was a challenge. I kind of started it before I was ready. And, you know, my audience was so far away and couldn't come, you know, across the whole world for that. And so I learned the hard way, you know, but that created, like, even though that wasn't a success, it really wasn't that bad in the long run, because I learned so much from doing it. And then I learned about what didn't work. So the next time I did a retreat, you know, it was sold out. So, you know, being willing to fail because you're not ready, you know, and you're never ready for a lot of things. And like when I did my first retreat, I didn't know how to do a retreat and how to market it. I did it like 2 months ahead of time, not even. So people didn't have enough time to book flights and everything. You know, I just kind of spur of the moment wanted to do it. And sure, it wasn't a financial success, but it put me on a path to learning what I needed to know to doing it, you know, consistently now, where I can sell out almost everything I do.
I'm curious. So a lot of people, they don't try and do something because of their anxiety and fear of failure. How did you get past that? Did you just not have the fear of failure because you were a little ignorant about the whole thing? Or did you kind of suppress it in some way? How did you overcome that in order to have your first retreat?
Well, I don't think anyone is fearless, right? Like, it's just how you deal with fear, I guess. And for me, like, anything big and new, I'm scared. Like, it's like, I know I might fail and I probably will fail, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, there's that fear and you want to minimize what you can do to minimize your failure, right? But to me, it's like something I learned in flow psychology is called high consequences. It's a trigger for getting into flow. And for me, I just schedule things in the near future, like retreats, launches, webinars, you know, and then I have to do them. Mm-hmm. And then I can't back out of it, you know? And I find as an entrepreneur, if I didn't do that, then I would just apply what they call, and I guess, Parkinson's Law, where work just expands endlessly. You know, your dreams never happen because you never set deadlines for them. Mm-hmm. And you never really make them happen. So yeah, I think the high consequences of just 30 days from now, I'm going to do a weekend with entrepreneurs here in Toronto right now. Schedule it, book it, you know, book the space, set an ad budget, a few thousand bucks. You know, that's high consequences. It could fail. But it's just, I do it and then I'm stuck with it. And I find, you know, halfway through, I'm like, I'm not prepared. I got to hustle. And, you know, so it happens sometimes. But then I can't back out of it. I'm stuck with it. And then it works out fine because yeah. It's like that pressure. And you need a bit of that, you know, not too much where you like push yourself over the edge, but high consequences I find very, 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 very helpful. Mm.
Right. Having commitments that you can't back out of. Even I know Tim Ferriss, he'll schedule dates when he wants to travel at the beginning of the year in the calendar. He doesn't know where, but he'll know that that is a week that it's going to be travel. And you sort of try and plan out your day or your week or your year. And even every Sunday, I found it incredibly beneficial. I follow a format using a software called Airtable by a friend named Nat Eliason, who created a great blog post. It'll be in the show notes about how he structures his, he has a 25-year goal. Even Taylor Pearson, I don't know if you know him, he has a great course on focus.
Yeah, it was amazing. The interface, the way it's structured is like spreadsheets should have been designed, you know?
Yeah. And so I'll have the annual goals, then kind of quarterly and weekly goals. And it can be difficult to always update it. But when I do, I have this clear idea of what I need to be working on. Because I'll have my to-do list that has all these tasks, but it's very difficult to differentiate just the administrative stuff that doesn't really make a huge difference versus those impactful goals that leave me feeling happy and satisfied that I am going somewhere, I'm making progress.
Yeah, just having that habit of planning things out, even if you don't stick to the perfect plan, it's just so important because it is easy to just to like do the easy work and get distracted by all this stuff and then miss out on the things you really want to do. Mm.
So we are getting near the end. I'm curious, can you tell me about DIY Genius, what it's about and where your headspace is right now?
Yeah. So to me, I'm just passionate about self-education, about all the ways we can learn now using the internet without necessarily going to school. And if you want certain professions and certain jobs, you know, school is great. I have no problem with school. But I just, for me, it wasn't the system I liked. And usually the people that, you know, I work with, they're usually creative. They really want to do something creative with their lives. And they want a different system. And I think the internet now provides all these different niches and businesses that can be built and ways to learn and ways to live that, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago weren't even possible. So DIY Genius is really just about how can you make a life where you can live, work, and learn anywhere? How can you really do creative work that matters, you know, work you really enjoy, and just getting clarity about that and learning to tell your story, to market yourself, to build your own brand. And I'm passionate about teaching online. I'm passionate about retreats. So I work with different people that want to make retreats and want to take learning out of a classroom into a forest or somewhere different. Because I think we need to change the model of schooling where we just sit in a desk, you know, a chair in a classroom in rows, where it's just like a batch processing, standardized lecturing model, and really more of an education system based on like people's unique gifts and how they can be developed in a way that serves the interests of society and the interests of humanity on a global scale. Because we have these huge problems today in the world, this ecological crisis, you know, disharmony on almost every level of the global system that could really go bad. And I think people have to step up, young people especially, and really do something about it, because if they don't do something about it, who else is going to do it, right? Like, mm-hmm. So I think I'm really a believer in empowering people to move beyond institutions and you know, these global governments and forces that maybe have different interests and really support communities and people just to really solve these problems themselves rather than relying on maybe the UN or the United States or, you know, some big entity to do it. Because it's not usually the way it works in nature. Usually nature is like grassroots, bottom-up, self-organizing systems. And I think the whole centralization in the world in the last 100, 150 years has led to a lot of problems for people, people's health, but also for the health of the planet. Mm.
See clarity and be empowered to follow your own path and get outside the regular system. I'm not sure how well I'm phrasing that, but I think a lot of good stuff.
Find your focus and, you know, do creative work you enjoy. That's really what it's all about.
And that bombshell, I think we'll end it there. Thank you again for being on the podcast, Kyle.
Thanks, Cody.
Hey guys, this is Cody again. I hope you enjoyed that episode of Mind Hack. And if you're interested in getting more Mind Hack worthy stuff straight to your inbox, then you might consider signing up for my weekly newsletter. It often contains links to new episodes, blog posts, and other interesting finds I found on the interweb in the past week. It pretty much focuses around productivity and efficiency. So if that's your thing, then be sure to visit my website at codymclain.com. That's MCLAIN.com to sign up. Also, if there are any interesting websites, companies, books, blog posts, quotes, or anything else that was mentioned in this episode, you can find it all and more by visiting the official website for the Mind Hack Show at mindhack.com. And as always, if you have any feedback, good or bad, I want to hear it. Send me a tweet, email, or what have you on either of my websites, as my goal with this show is to give you the maximum value in the shortest amount of time. That's all for now, guys. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you guys again soon.